There you have it, opening up the second hour of Solid Gold Saturday, the Horses, Derek Dunn. I was just talking to Johnny off-air about the most famous Irish riff of all time, or worldwide riff of all time. Did it come to you easily, Johnny? Or you...
I was kind of lucky in the sense that I had been playing it for a while on tenor banjo. It was a tune that I knew. Yeah. The tune was O'Neill's Cavalry. And I'd been playing it for a while. I possibly may have learned the tune in the County of Limerick. At a session from, you know, from a player, but I had been playing it on banjo, and I'd been toying around with it. I kind of sort of put it from banjo to guitar. I knew it would be a very strong riff,
yeah.
You know, if I put it. So I worked on it for a while, and sure enough, like it turned out to be a good one, as I say.
Let's go into your day in the Horses, Johnny.
Yeah.
And you're still together. You're recording at the moment, are you?
We are actually doing a bit of recording at the moment. Yeah. It was all sparked off going back to last March. It was a great exhibition up in Derry. That was put on by three super fans of the band. You know, and they spent a long time, you know, getting some amazing material together from all parts of the world, and one of the guys, Jim Nealis, had a fantastic collection. Every poster that Horses ever had, and he had them all specially framed. That started the whole thing. Yeah. And there was another lad called Paul Callaghan, Kingscourt, and a lad called Stephen Furris. So the three boys got together, and they sort of had a couple of ideas initially. It was going to be maybe a small, you know, small,
yeah.
But it blossomed.
It
blossomed, yeah. And it ended up being put on in Derry, you know, the whole exhibition. And that sort of, the band agreed to, you know, to come and open the exhibition initially, you know. Like we hadn't any even kind of plans to do, you know, play or do anything like that. But again, that as time went on, we agreed to kind of do a short acoustic 20-minute set, you know,
yeah.
Which we did at the exhibition. Yeah. It was featured on Nationwide, I think, and so that sort of sparked it, you know. We were actually, for the first time we broke up in 1980, so, like, you know, for the first time the band actually played together.
You broke up, Johnny, was it solely because of musical indifference, or, you know, and where you wanted to go and where you wanted to bring the band? Or was it the fact that you'd just come to the end of the journey at that time?
I think, I think possibly we had come to the end of the journey, you know. Some people actually, well, it's funny, like, but the lifespan of a band seems to be, in a lot of cases, 10 years, or, I don't know, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there are a lot of, you know, bands that what you've got to do and say, mm-hmm. like, and, you know, that's not always the case, of course, but we had sort of like reached a point where we thought we had all we had to say,
yeah.
was said, you know, that,
yeah.
kind of thing, and we weren't really sure if they, going into the 80s,
mm-hmm.
would there was a lot of changes, of course, late 70s, 77, 78, the whole punk explosion,
yeah,
a lot of things changed, you know,
yeah.
So we had played. We had toured America at that stage quite a bit, like, and a pretty big following. The last.
Did you want to do? Obviously, everyone wants to do well stateside in America. I mean, you've hit the jackpot, you know, financially, and I mean to be recognised stateside and do very, very well. You've done it all. Once you've cracked Europe, that's the natural progression.
It is, of course. Yeah, for every band, for every European band. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
what was it that stopped you going that little bit further, Johnny?
Further, yeah. Possibly that they thought that maybe we weren't going to, you know, in a really big sense, in the, you know, the EU, you know, the,
yeah,
you know, like, maybe we weren't going to be really big of a success. I think that is possibly the, like, well, certainly one of the main factors anyway, you know.
Yeah.
But the band, you know, had actually built up quite a following, especially on the East Coast of America.
Yeah.
You know, Boston, Philadelphia, New York.
Yeah.
A bit on the West Coast, San Francisco, of course.
Steve was telling me it's all males that follow the horses. So I don't believe it for a minute.
Wasn't a big bed factor in there.
Oh, yeah, he said the lads went to your gigs and the girls went to his gigs.
This is a good time to say hello to my wife, Anne.
It is a good time.
and my daughter, Sean. I welcome them back from their holidays. Don't listen to this.
Greetings from Kerry, and thanks for loaning them to us for a few hours. Steve, as you said earlier, you're only in the Miami for 18 months or so.
Yeah.
And then obviously 75, and the incident happened. And you went on, it wasn't something that you weren't going to repeat, even though for a short sense you did with the new Miami. Yeah. At what stage did you say, right, this is it, I'm changing, I'm doing my own thing?
Yeah. Well, when you're growing up, you want to be famous, you want to be a pop star. Everybody does, you know, you put the guitar on and prance about in front of the mirror and think, I'm Paul McCartney, you know. But when you get there, it's a lot more than, it's a lot of hard work to stay there. But what I found very difficult was the fact that I had sort of honed my instrument for a long time, and all of a sudden I was famous for something else, famous for being involved in the incident. And after 12 months it became enough, too much for me, and I decided I want to pack this in. I didn't like the recognition, I didn't like any of that, so I just wanted to get my head together, and I went back down to Carrigan's Tour and played. I was very lucky insofar as that I had great support from my wife Anne. As Johnny would tell you, without somebody like that behind you,
absolutely, yeah,
your head can be turned in all sorts of directions, you know. But we survived it, and I think that's perhaps one of that's the catalyst that Johnny and myself, that we, you know, we've come through some pretty difficult times, and we've survived. Here we are, still playing, and very luckily playing. I think that's the mark of success.
Yeah.
If you can, after 30 years of whatever,
yes,
you can say, I'm still playing, I'm still enjoying it.
I'm still enjoying it, which is, I think, is the big, you know, really, you enjoy, yeah, it really is an awful lot to do with it, the action, you know, enjoying what, you know, enjoying.
Yeah, we played in at the heart of trad music there recently. We played up in Clare,
mm-hmm.
And when we play our trad stuff, we take quite funky.
Yeah, we
I thought we might have been seen out by the sheriff.
Yeah, so we were saying, here we are in the heart of the home of traditional music, you know.
And we were under the same roof as our hero Seamus Ennis.
Seamus Ennis actually used to stay up and play there. Yeah,
in the high. Yeah. But we play the trad stuff against hip hop and house. Rhythms,
yeah.
And we thought, if we can get away with this in Clare,
mm-hmm.
we get away with it neither. You know? But we got four encores, so we must have done something right.
Yeah, lovely people, I have to say, at the gig, and it was really good. Yeah. Yeah.
We like playing, in fact, being in Kerry is a great balance for us, because both Horsets and Miami and The Crack, which was one of my real pet projects, with CBS at the time. Funny enough, we always associated Kerry with reggae music. We were huge into reggae. We had a number called Handcuffs, which was, and to see the young people
at that time was
huge. So they were quite, it was great place to play. Kerry was a great thing, always, obviously, the pub fair and... It was just a wonderful
The Rosalie International Fest.
Yeah, we headlined the Rosalie in the square last year. Yeah,
somewhere. Yeah.
We did all of the festivals. We went right the way from Boncrano up the north. We headlined at the Rory Gallagher Festival in Ballyshannon.
Twice. I think it was twice. Yes, it was indeed. Yeah.
So we've done something.
A number of other festivals as well, actually. Yeah. Over the last two summers, you know.
But there's a massive return to live music and to good music now, both here and in the UK.
It is, yeah. It was something we were talking about during the week, Steve, that people are becoming more appreciative of live performances, of original material. And it drifted away for quite a while.
It did, yeah. And this, unfortunately, the demise of the show band,
yeah.
The problem was that there was no place for young people to learn their trade. I always made a point of joining, so I joined a band called the McDelahunty Junior Orchestra when I knew that everybody in the band was far superior to myself. I just wanted to learn from these guys, you know, and I did, but unfortunately, during the 80s and 90s, there was no place to go, you know.
It all, yeah, it did, yeah, it did. I think, you know, I mean, the whole disco thing really, really took, you know, it really took over. And it just, which is unfortunate, really, because, I mean, as Steve said, the young people had been in the 60s and 70s, you know, learning instruments and, you know, live playing, you know, getting into it. It all seemed to go, you know, out the window, didn't it? You know?
Yeah. I have no problem with discos, as long as people see a disco or some disco and dance.
Mm-hmm.
But for somebody to tell me that, you know, you go sit down and listen to a disco, that to me just doesn't make any sense.
Just,
yeah. But Steve, would it be fair to say that, you know, being in the show band itself and doing the gigs and playing the music that you played, that a lot of the musicians that were in show bands lost their own originality and their identity by being in the show band in the first place?
Well, the good ones, they would always stand out. There's, going back to, say, the Clipper Carton, who were probably the first real show band, the first guys to stand up, at least before that, the orchestras or bands would sit down and play the parts. So the Clipper Carton were the first, and they had people like Barney Skillen, who would have been, he'd stand out anywhere.
Fabulous guitar player, but yeah. And you're talking about like early 60s there, Steve.
Yeah. And inspired us all. We would go, Johnny,
we were kids, kids.
Johnny would have gone, I would have gone, Dave Krim, Gabe Ross, all of these people would have gone and been inspired by this man. But there were some great, one of the most influential bass players in my time, for me, was a guy from Cork called Cranston King, who encouraged me and told me that I was, you know, had something going when everybody else thought, you know, this guy's playing rubbish. But when you try, I think the best thing you can ever do is encourage a kid, you know, and as I say, you know, in 100 years' time, nobody's caring what you earn, but the world may be a different place because you were important in the life of a child, and that's very important to me. Give somebody encouragement.
Okay, we'll take this music.
With Brian Hurley.
Welcome back to the programme. Brian Hurley with you until 8 with Johnny Feen of the Horsets and Steve Travers of the Miami. But then, after the Miami, it was something would it be fair to say totally different, Steve?
Totally different, yeah. As I say, I wanted to get away from all of that. And we put a ska band together originally, because ska was a thing. It was a bit of fun. We had Angus McInally fronting the band. Angus playing guitar player and funny guy. And when Angus went to RTE, we sort of had to come up with some really good plans. So the singer in the band, Tommy Lundy, who sounded very, very like Paul McCartney, sort of gives an opportunity to develop the songwriting side of things. And so we got an album deal through this song. We did a song called When the Time Comes, which was produced by Johnny's bass player, Barry Devlin, from Horslips, and it sounded so like Paul McCartney, I suppose. Everybody thought it was, including Johnny.
Absolutely. The first time I heard it, you know, I was...
And you did get word back on it, Steve.
We did, yeah. In fact, Paul McCartney's friend, a guy called Earl Loken, who had done the tour with Paul, took it up to Macca and said, have a listen to this. You didn't tell me you'd release some stuff under another name. And
yes.
Paul McCartney was well amused, loved the album, and George, I was going to say George Harrison, no, George Martin, their producer, wrote to me and said, well, I like your stuff, but it's a bit too close, so I'll give it a break.
Can we have a listen? You want to dedicate this?
Yeah, I'd like to dedicate this to the singer Tommy Lundy, who unfortunately died last November of cancer, and miss him very much, but this is a tribute, the album is a tribute to him.
Let's have a listen.